are back after a week off. The Mainland Podcast is back with episode number 53. I am Michael Citro, the managing editor and founder of The Mainland. Joining me is our writer, Andrew Harrison. And Andrew, how you doing tonight, buddy?
I'm pretty good. It's been it was nice to have a week off last week, and then we've had some, you know, events that I don't think we're really going to cover because it's, you know, one of those things. But I'm ready to get back into it, get back to some football, and hopefully the clubs can do us well.
Yes, as we're recording this, we have a 17-day layoff for Orlando City since the May 29th draw, come from behind draw against New York City FC. Been a lot of downtime for the senior club. Guys went on vacations and went to play international matches and things like that. And, you know, we're getting ready to welcome everybody back, although probably not everybody on Wednesday for the U.S. Open Cup. It'll probably be, you know, a good amount of OCB guys and backups and that kind of thing. So I just want to ask you, you know, this during this layoff with Copa America going on and you know, Euro 2016 firing up. I mean, is this just like a great summer to watch soccer or what?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's really kind of one of those, you know, the Copa is almost, it's been free soccer. They had their tournament last year, so the Centenario is really being that added icing on the cake. And I think it took a while to get going, but the Copa has really kind of come into its own. And then it's really just been joined by a cracking European Championship so far. Great cup summer of soccer, and then we've still got the Olympics yet to come. We get a kind of that break where MLS comes back for the summer when it's really the only thing around, and then we dive straight into all the European leagues again and the Olympics, and really MLS gets down to crunch time. So it's been a great summer so far.
So Copa or Euro, what do you like better?
I'm a Euro, but that's just because I'm from there. I got many more dogs in the fight, and I feel like just because this is a free tournament, it means, you know, the Euros are never going to kind of do that. This is about the pride of Europe. And I think it's, you know, you see so many people not get a chance. And, you know, we may see some outsider win it again this year, which would be really nice.
We've seen already some upsets and some surprise results. But what do you think? I wanted to stay with Copa for a second. What do you think of the rumblings we're hearing about maybe doing this, you know, sort of as an ongoing thing where there's going to be not just CONMEBOL teams, but also CONCACAF teams and keep this sort of format going?
I am personally not a big fan. I think everybody should. There's a reason that confederations exist, and it's about matching those up and getting to play the same teams week in, week out. I understand that the U.S. is kind of wanting better opposition, which you'd get by, in, you know, playing more common ball teams, but I just don't think this is right. There's a reason that the Copa America has reached 100 years. Should leave well alone. I think the U.S. can develop its own tournament, and I think it really has to concentrate on getting a strong primary league before it starts worrying about itself having to play hard international competition, you know, every game instead of just running in these friendlies where they knock up a Brazil-Haiti score.
Well, I'll respect your opinion, but I actually like this. I think that I think there's a perception at least that the European sides are superior, and that you know, that there's a little bit of a gap, and that maybe a combined CONCACAF and CONMEBOL you know, entry process into World Cup and that kind of thing might be just what they need to sort of reach that level, maybe more of an East versus Western hemisphere kind of thing, even though, you know, you got the Asian and the African confederations and that kind of thing.
But that's the World Cup. That's what, like, I don't want to take anything away from that. I think all of a sudden you're asking for basically a mini World Cup to prepare those teams for another World Cup. I feel like I understand that's kind of that's not what the Euros are. It's not trying to merge anything. That is one confederation.
But you got to look at the number of teams in that confederation. And the number of teams in that confederation versus teams in CONCACAF, CONMEBOL is, you know, it's probably not that big of a disparity, but you're talking about a lot of CONCACAF teams that are these tiny island nations.
Yeah.
Basically, what it is like if you took UEFA and you added, you know, tons and tons of the little tiny islands in there and that are maybe currently playing, you know, in the Asian Confederation, that kind of thing. I just think I don't think of it as a mini World Cup. I think of it as a path to qualification, and it's, you know, it's a very historic, prestigious tournament. I think it would add a little bit more color and bite to it. And also, I think that, you know, I'm not one of those traditionalist guys that thinks that things can never be touched and everything is sacred. I think that can be exciting if you make some changes. So, I mean, that's just my own opinion.
That's okay. The world is built on great differing opinions.
That's right. So, did you happen to catch any of the matches in Orlando?
I was able to watch them on TV. We just got a lot going on that I wasn't able to make it down there. And I think, I mean, rain for game two, even if I'd had tickets, I wouldn't have been going.
Yeah, you know, I was surprised. It was the first game I thought was going to be the best game, and it ended up being the worst of the three. And, you know, the one I didn't expect a whole lot from was quite a game. I thought, Panama-Bolivia was a really exciting game. The rain probably, was it wasn't as big a factor as everybody thought. And I think that it didn't really make the game sloppy or anything. I thought that the pitch held up very well for all three games. There wasn't a lot of slipping or anything like that, which we've seen on some of the other fields. So I think that the guys that did the surface, the men and women that worked on putting the natural grass surface on top of the artificial turf at the Camping World Stadium did a really great job of maintaining that. And it was really a lot of fun for me to see these nations and their, you know, the passion of their crowds and their cultures and all of that mingling before the games and that kind of thing. It was really an exciting time for me. And I thought that the soccer even was a bit secondary to the spectacle of the whole thing.
And I think that's what, you know, it's great that we were able to attract a tournament of this quality, because I think that's what, you know, international soccer is played on that level. It's about those cultures coming together and seeing those different styles of football that kind of develop in each country. So I think it was really great that they're able to see it. And, you know, we didn't see any of the events that are happening in the Euros where fans are clashing. These people came to party and have a good time, and we were able to come out the other side of that, and that's pretty good.
Yeah, in fact, what's cool is we did our predictions last week, and everybody, I mean, obviously none of us picked a true dark horse, but all of our teams are still alive that we picked to win the title. I had Mexico, I think Daniel had Colombia, and I think Austin went with Argentina, maybe.
Yep.
So, you know, obviously none of those would be huge surprises, but, you know, I played a little homer, went with the CONCACAF team, but, you know, suddenly the U.S. is playing pretty well, so they might even have a shot if they can get through their side of the bracket. So, which is going to be a tall order, but we'll see what happens.
They're getting there. They've been playing really well, and I think by, you know, Brazil's just complete capitulation at this tournament again made it a little easier to at least get to the semifinals. Hopefully,
let's talk about Brazil a little bit. Dunga gets fired, obviously. It was an eventful three games for Brazil. The first game, they played Ecuador and drew 0-0, but they should have lost that game 1-0 on a strange decision by the assistant referee, who was definitely shielded by the goal, decided that the ball was completely over the line. It was not. We've seen photos all over the internet that are blown up that show clearly that the ball was still on the line, and that it was just a horrific goal for Brazil to have given up, but it didn't count. And they get the draw. But now everybody's talking about the handball goal that sent them out. And, you know, conveniently forgetting about the draw that they got when they should have been, you know, down. They should have been on 0 points after the first round. So, as it turns out, the teams that finished first and second in their group should have finished first and second in their group. So, it all worked out that because they had the goal they shouldn't have had, the goal that should have counted didn't, and the goal that shouldn't have counted did, and both of those affected their point totals in opposite directions. So it was very eventful. Dunga is out, and that brings me to the point that I really wanted to bring up, is that Dunga seemed to be a very big proponent of having a veteran leader like Kaká come in and be part of the national team program. I don't see that going forward as something that a lot of managers will do. And I think that this actually will help Orlando City in the long run because, you know, I think most managers will move on from a 34-year-old, no matter how legendary they are, and go with – because Brazil is just so, so chock full of talent. Do you think that this could be a thing where, you know – a good thing for Orlando City where they won't lose Kaká as often?
I think without a doubt. I think that he even himself acknowledged that he was lucky to kind of get those call-ups and get another chance to play for his international side. I think with Dunga on his way out the door for the second time, and also that strategy hasn't been working. They haven't gotten back. They haven't recovered from that World Cup summer final loss with that strategy. They're going to have to try something new. They have some amazing young talent. That doesn't mean I think they're going to completely ostracize all of those old people. And when I say old, I mean like over 26 that are, you know, plying all their trade in Europe's large five leagues. They're going to go back to what works, and that's great, entertaining football. And I think it's going to be done with young talent that's going to play a lot of people off the field. And they have to get ready for 2018, and they can't afford another big stumble. And the Olympics, when they roll around in August, will, I think, really set the national plan up for Brazil for the next decade, potentially, if they really don't win that either.
Yeah, it'll be, you know, it'll be interesting to see if Brazil can regroup and get back to where they should be. They definitely have the talent to do it, but of late, it just can't seem to put all the pieces together properly. And you know, we see a lot of that from time to time around world football. We see teams that, you know, obviously have talent that somehow just can't get it right. And I know, you know, England scuffled with that for a few years where they had talent and they just couldn't get results and in big tournaments. And, you know, they obviously didn't get the result they wanted to start off Euro either. So
I was going to say,
the late goal.
It hasn't really changed. I feel like we've been in this situation for so long now that it's just incredible that we just have a bunch of individual players and no team unity whatsoever. And I think to a certain extent, Brazil has paid that price too by allowing people to leave Brazil at such an early stage. They've not managed to develop that team unity that they were so known for back in the early 90s, you know, actually all the way from Pelé all the way through like the late 90s, which is really when their troubles really started to hit the fan.
So who do you see winning Copa and Euro 2016?
I'm going with home favorite for Euros. I just think despite France's kind of slow start in the opening game, they will put it together. They are going to be able to bring it home. They have so much talent, and France is actually one of those teams that can perform on the big stage. So I'm going with them, and I'm actually going to go with Italy. I think that Italy can make it all the way to the final as well against France. They wouldn't meet until then due to the positioning and the tables, I believe. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go with a France-Italy final, both big tournament teams, and I think France will come out on top. Copa, it's a toss-up, but I am going with Argentina. I think Messi gets his first title and beats Ronaldo to it to firmly cement his place at the head of the queue for their race to the Hall of Fame or whatever FIFA eventually comes up with.
Well, whatever it is, it'll be corrupt and somebody will make millions of dollars off of under the table.
Hey, we've got to have something to hold on to, right?
Well, you know, soccer is all about tradition, right?
Yep.
I don't know who's going to win Euro. I think Italy got a very impressive opening win over Belgium, but I don't think it's anything really. I don't think it's new, anything new for Belgium and Portugal to sort of disappoint on the international stage. And you know, Portugal opened with a 1-1 draw against Iceland today. So I think that. Portugal and Belgium, very, very talented teams, but for whatever reason, they never seem quite able to put it together. And, you know, I think that Italy's got a really good chance. The hosts are very big favorites. I think everybody is picking them pretty much. So because everybody else is picking them, I can't pick them. And I'm going to say Germany gets it done.
Okay.
So that's just, you know, Germany just is, they are the machine right now. They're just, they just look very, very strong to me. So that's where I'm going. But and I'll stick with Mexico, even though, you know, their fans can just go hang themselves for that chant.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Open Cup is this week, and we're recording this the night before Orlando City takes on Jacksonville Armada in Jacksonville at Jacksonville University. Not at the normal place where Armada play, but in a different venue. It's fairly small. I guess they're bringing in some bleachers to accommodate some extra seating, but I still think it's going to be a fairly small crowd on a midweek. And, you know, obviously it doesn't really behoove us much to talk about the game, considering that by the time this airs, that it will be over. But I wanted to just get your opinion of the U.S. Open Cup and your takes on the U.S. Open Cup in general. Teams always say that they take this seriously, but every team you see just basically plays reserves up until they win a few rounds, and then they get sort of serious about it. It's almost like, you know, the big teams in England in the FA Cup, where they play guys that never play, and then once the Premier League teams are playing other Premier League teams, then they start to get a little more serious and play their normal players a little bit more. Do you think that is a sound strategy, or do you think that teams are choosing to just say, you know, we're not that interested, but if we, you know, if we make get a couple wins, then we'll take it seriously? Is that what they're doing?
I think without a doubt, you know, you're playing for a place in the CONCACAF Champions League to be able to get to that next level where you need to be on the international stage, get that money. Something comes from that. But what you have to realize is that the league is still, despite MLS's love for the game and the growth of soccer in the United States, we're still playing with a league that is balanced on a very fine knife edge. You have to get people to come to the games that you play week in, week out to be able to stay afloat. The cup run is great, but it doesn't have that magic of the FA Cup run where you can have a bunch of people who met in a pub all of a sudden playing Arsenal. You kind of do have that here, but it's never going to happen. And I think when they said, I see two problems with the Open Cup in general. One, I think the geographic region limitation continuously means that you always play the same teams. I think that very formulaic is not good for the average soccer fan to be like, oh, we're playing the same team again. That's great. Well, I'm going to go see that game. You have to be able to move out of that, get that new competition. And I understand it's all about cost, but I think maybe you should take off that geographic limiter at a certain point rather than keep it all the way up to really almost the semifinals final when it kind of breaks apart. Other thing is, I think when they said that you had to play your main team, you basically gave up one of the reasons why you wanted an MLS team to own a USL team. You wanted them to develop talent, and then all of a sudden you said, you know what, we're actually not going to give you the ability to play that talent. You're going to have to use your main guys. You're going to have to go for it. You should have had that ability to stick with the USL and take the risk. And to be truly honest with you, I would have loved to have seen the Lions take on OCB for that rivalry. Yeah. That's something I would have been okay with. They wouldn't have gone super hard. Nobody would have wanted to injure anybody else. But I still would have loved to. That would have been a great boost for either side. Like if OCB beat the Lions, all of a sudden it's like, well, should I be playing there? Should I be? You know, it's great. That's great in the squad competition and have it mean something. Until you get the buy-in from everybody, it's still just going to be a thing that major MLS sides don't put in their big guys until it really means something to them.
Why do you think that these games don't get very good attendance? Do you think it's just because it's midweek? Do you think it's because people don't want to spend money to see, you know, the reserves play an NASL team or a USL team, or is it a combination of those things? Is it that they don't respect the tournament? Is it all of it? I mean, what do you think it is?
I think it's a little bit of everything. I think obviously weekday really hurts it, always is going to. We see that in virtually all sports, unless it's a playoffs or something, really attendance is always hurt midweek. It's going to go late. You got kids. You're just not going to do it. I also think it's that people don't understand the tradition of the cup. You know, you're trying to ask somebody to buy into a tournament that is, I can't even remember the first year. It's old, and
Yeah.
people on it, they don't see that, they don't know about it, they don't have that passion and that feeling that, oh my God, this is a, you know, our team once won this. If you could kind of get that mystery and that magic about it, I think you would see more people have a love for it. But it's not going to be something that's built overnight, and it's not going to be built by trying to fake it. It has to be real.
Yeah, I agree with that part, especially because, you know, I think one of the things that drives events like this is great stories. And I don't think a USL team beating an MLS team is a great story when the MLS team is playing a lot of, you know, reserves, guys that are loaned out and guys that are, you know, 19, 20, 21-year-olds that are loaned out to their B team. That to me isn't the same thing as if, you know, LA Galaxy's playing, you know, Robbie Keane and Robbie Rogers and you know, Gio Dos Santos and all those guys, and then they get beat by Orange County Blues. That's not the same thing. But those are the kinds of moments that really build those tournaments, and that's sort of what the FA Cup has going for it, is you every year you see these teams from the lower levels kind of make runs, and even when they don't make runs, they might, you know, take a, you know, one of the minnows might take one of the giants to, you know, extra time or whatever, or even kicks, spot kicks. So those are the kinds of things that really kind of can capture imaginations and build excitement over years. And the other thing is, it's not on television. So, you know, you don't have the exposure that the FA, I mean, the FA Cup matches are, they're played in England, but we see them here live. You know, nobody watches, you know, the FA Cup live, or I mean the US Open Cup live, unless they're watching on YouTube. So, you know, that's a problem. Why do you think there's no coverage of this event at all on television?
I think once again, you haven't got the buy-in. You know, you watch the FA Cup when they do it over here. Yeah, they don't start with the early rounds. They don't start with until the third round when the big teams enter it. I'm okay with that. They do start a little earlier in England. I think round two is where they start really getting it onto the BBC and things. But they don't have the buy-in. They don't have that thing. There's no advertising. There's no marketing to be able to get that. And I think also the problem that this tournament has suffered a lot from this year is the US Open Cup doesn't even regulate itself. It says that we're going to be in charge of the rosters, and then you lose two teams for picking bad rosters. You can't expect a team that has a very limited budget to go back through 6 months' worth of results and say, oh my goodness, this player that we just signed, or who turned up because he's moving around the country playing for different teams, once played for, you know, Oshkosh, Wisconsin, and we can't play him this round. They've already taken away that magic before they've even built it. And that's a big thing to recover. You know, what happens if you say, okay, we're going to broadcast this game, and then it's like, oh no, that game actually doesn't exist because that team got pushed out because they didn't play the right requisite player. It's such a hard thing. And I think until you get the networks to buy into it, I think ESPN3 is trying to do that with the College Cup and NASL, but they're not getting great numbers. People aren't tuning into NASL, so why would they go even lower until the big teams come in?
Yeah, that's a good point. And you know, it would be so easy to avoid some of those problems. I mean, the you ask a player, you know, did you play in any matches that were, you know, would make you ineligible, or are you kept, you know, are you cup tied to another team? They don't necessarily know. The Villages played a player who turned out to be ineligible. They played him in two different matches, and they played him against the Krays, and they won that game. And they played him against Charleston. They won that game on penalties, and then had to forfeit and let Charleston back in. And Charleston then promptly lost to Jacksonville. But you know, this was a guy who played for a team in South Florida in a qualifying round, and it's entirely probable that the player doesn't realize that a qualifying round counts as being cup tied for an actual tournament match. It just doesn't make any sense. They should either make those matches not count toward being cup tied, or do a better job with the roster, perusals, because they did come out this year and say we're going to have to ratify all of the rosters and check them, and they do that, and everybody, they checked the rosters for against the Craze, and the player was on it, and he played only the last 5 minutes, but he still played, and the Craze, had they gotten their appeal within 24 hours, they would have moved on to play Charleston, but they didn't get it in. And then Charleston appealed. And of course that's what tipped the Craze off that, hey, that guy played against us too. And they don't have those kind of, they don't necessarily have those kind of resources. No. And they might have guys that don't even work full time for the team, probably just have regular day jobs. And here they are expected to know all the rules and not only know all the rules, but have time to do all the paperwork and the research and all of that stuff. And it's just not going to happen. And the U.S. Soccer has to do a better job. If you're going to check the rosters and okay them, I mean, you should catch this guy the first time he plays in, you know, and is ineligible. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't let it get to that point where he's playing against Charleston, right?
Exactly. And I think you have to realize that also the qualifying rounds, when you go back and look at them, they were almost like 7 months before you get to that round. How is that? That player thinks, oh, wait, I played in 2015 for that team. Of course it doesn't count. But then when you step up and say, we're going to take care of all of that for you because we have the resources to be able to do that. And then you ultimately disadvantage some teams that potentially could have made a lot more money by even just going up to Charleston and getting that extra gate or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I personally think the better option would have been to force a replay.
Yeah, I agree. I think that a replay would have been a fairer result. And in fact, if they wanted to say, okay, you know what, you're right. You know, you're right, Charleston. Your appeal is approved. They used an illegal player, but that illegal player also played in the previous round. So then you have a playoff between the two teams that both, played against that illegal player. Yep. And at least you have the Craze and the Charleston Battery earning it on the field. One of them has to earn the right to go to the next round.
Rather than just letting them through. And I think that's what makes it disingenuous to a certain point. Like, I haven't seen that happen in the FA Cup. I haven't seen that happen in the Champions League. I haven't seen that happen in, you know, a major, even like just a League Two, like a French tournament, or you don't see that. That's amateur hour. And if you want people to take notice, you can't run it like an amateur Sunday league event.
Was it, I want to say, Champions League, but it may have been Europa League, maybe, that Celtic got to go through after losing because of an ineligible player from I believe it was a Swedish or Swiss team.
A few years ago. You're probably going back there in history, and I think you might be right, but I feel like it was also that he played numerous games. Like, I don't think it was just that it was just against them.
Maybe. I don't know. I don't remember it off the top of my head, but being a Celtic fan, it sticks in my mind that they were eliminated but ended up moving on. But certainly that is a rarity compared to the early rounds of the FA Cup, of the U.S. Open Cup.
They moved into the Champions League after Legia Warsaw played an ineligible player in a two-leg game.
That's it. Yes. All right, so but I'm excited. I like the U.S. Open Cup, and I think it's a great competition, and I like the way it sort of forces the managers of these teams to think about their lineups and who can go two games in a week and who maybe they have to rest or maybe can come off the bench and play 15, 20 minutes if they need to, but they have to have them fresh for the weekend. And I think that Orlando City, as long as they're not playing MLS clubs, are going to go with a very conservative lineup, which may hurt OCB a little bit, actually. Because, I mean, the thing is, it all depends on what kind of contract these players are on. And I know that the two teams have the ability to, I believe, loan up to four players, I think it is. So what you could probably see is guys that are on MLS contracts like Harrison Heath and, potentially a guy like Tyler Turner, although he's probably suspended, I'm guessing, because of the last game. But you know, guys like Connor Donovan, guys like that can play. And oh wow, Chile just scored again while we're doing this. But anyway, speaking of great tournaments, so yeah, you're going to see guys like Harrison Heath, Connor Donovan, that are able to come up and play for the team, and they might play again, you know, alongside guys like Luke Bowden, who aren't getting a lot of minutes, or maybe even Antonio Nocerino. And also there are limits on international players, so it's interesting to see how the coaches manage that, and like, which international players do I play? A Carlos Rivas would be perfect for this because he doesn't play full games really for Orlando City, so you could put him out there for 70 minutes and then still have him as a super sub, you know, on the weekend to play San Jose. And that's kind of what I like about it, is that little chess match that the managers have to play. And on the other hand, you know, the NASL right now, I believe, is on a break, so they can let everything hang out. They don't need to conserve anybody.
Yeah, they don't have to concede. They don't have to rest anybody. They've finished their spring season, I think, and then are heading into summer, like late July. But you know what also means they haven't been playing competitive games, but also a 70-day break on our side, and probably hasn't done us any favors.
Yeah, so maybe it's a good thing that there's more OCB guys play, because they've been playing games.
Yeah, and I like that chess match too. I actually like that there is a nationality limit. I like that they've kind of tried to insulate it like that. I think if they did that in the FA Cup, for an example, you'd see a lot more competitive teams, or a lot lower league teams, make huge runs. And I think that would really help the tournament grow back to being even bigger than it was, because people would love to see those competitions match up. I really am going to go with you. The chess match is great. It makes people think about their roster, and not just, oh, you know what, he's just languishing in OCB. No, I got to play him. Where does he fit into our system? And it also allows you to see whether or not that person is going to be a fit for you going forward, so you can make those decisions come the off season when they really matter.
Yeah, absolutely. And we saw Harrison Heath play against New York City FC in a fill-in role, and you know, he's a guy who can give you some spot minutes in MLS, but you really have to think, you know, is this a guy who is going to be there for us in 2-3 years? Is he going to be able to play? Is he ready now? Are we holding him back?
Mm-hmm.
You know, those are the kinds of questions that get answered in these types of matches. So it'll be fun, and hopefully Orlando City will be able to make a deep run, because, you know, as it goes along, a lot of teams, you know, as they start taking them more seriously. We saw it with Orlando City last year. They played better players each time out. You know, when they played Columbus, they played a more normal team. Columbus had played midweek and decided to, you know, roll the dice and play some backups, and they got knocked out. So, you know, it all kind of comes down to how the schedule sets up, and that plays into it. So there is some luck, and there's also, you know, how much do you go for it? And it'll be interesting to see how much he goes for it, because, you know, I believe that Adrian Heath, I mean, he said this, so that's why I believe it, but he has come out and said that his job, he believes, this year is dependent upon making the playoffs in MLS. So you know he's going to err on the side of you know, MLS games. So can Orlando City make a run? We will see. But as long as they're in it, we'll, of course, support them on their way.
Yeah, we got to be in it to win it, and I like that idea. But I also kind of like that he's acknowledging that he has to get something done this year. I think that's important. Mm-hmm. And because I don't like when people are like, oh yeah, he's been our coach for forever, he's not going anywhere. No, this is a game based on results. You have to win to keep the job.
Yeah, and I think if you know, if you're realistic and you think coming into a league, it's going to take X number of years to become competitive, you have to know that going in. And I think if it's just Phil Rollins and Adrian Heath, they go back a ways, they have a great, strong relationship, they understand each other, that's one thing. But he has more to answer to than just Phil Rollins. And I don't think that Flavio, you know, he comes in, he's already got a coach in place. I don't think that he's necessarily, you know, on board with being as patient. I think he's a guy who's, I mean, obviously he's Brazilian, he's used to results, because in Brazil, they get results. Mm-hmm. And he will pull the trigger a lot faster than Phil will. So You know, people that think that Adrian Heath is absolutely safe, even if they miss the playoffs, I don't necessarily agree with that. I think that the plan is working, and I think if they give him time, it will work. But I also think that they need to show improvement. And last year they missed by a spot. So if they show improvement, they're going to make the playoffs, right?
Yeah, I think if they can, I think they are improving year on year. I think that's how the system is built. But I think also going into a smaller season or a smaller stadium next season, there is the ability for some fan attrition. So that if it doesn't work out or we don't make the playoffs for a second year in a row and coach was to go, okay, people are going to be disheartened, but they also have 10,000 less seats to fill next year. That's I'm not trying to be downhearted on the club. They still have to make a marketing effort to get those people on single game tickets. But I don't think that the commitment to a coach is really going to necessarily be there when they're not trying to fill a 65,000 seater stadium.
Yeah, and this is a team with a waiting list for season ticket, so I don't think it's going to be a dramatic effect. I think this team wants to sell tickets, but they'll certainly. I mean, the stadium alone is going to draw some people next year, but they want results. They wanted, you can't just come into the league all brash with a defy expectations motto and then say, we're going to be patient, Your whole motto says you're not going to be patient. You're going for it, and if it's not working, you're going to make changes. So, I mean, I personally like Adrian Heath quite a bit. I had a number of conversations with him at training and seen him post game and that kind of thing, and even in some social settings. And he's a guy that you would like to have around in a long time. And I think he'll be successful wherever he goes. But it is an expansion team. And you have to brace for the possibility that you might let a coach go at the end of the year that will come back and bite you. But, at the same time, again, you got that defy expectations out there. You have to live up to that and go for it. So anyway, hopefully he'll just make it a moot point and make the playoffs this year.
Yeah. and maybe there is a point of moving him upstairs. I'm not talking to like a director of football role, but he has got that level of commitment to the community. Maybe there is that level of fan engagement. Maybe he moves behind the scenes if he isn't successful. You'd have to decide whether or not that's something you could do with whoever came in next if it doesn't work out for him. But what we've also seen is, he could be a great mentor. We've had a lot of people come up through our system that have turned into good coaches. Maybe that's also where he can excel in bringing in the lads in an academy role or a elevated role for OCB in recruitment. There are other potential positions for him other than head coach, I think, of this football franchise.
Sure. And of course, that would be up to what Heath, what Heath wants to do with his career. Does he want to continue to try to be successful in coaching, or does he want to stay in Orlando? I know he likes it here very much. But show me a coach that hasn't, liked where they've been and then got fired and just left and took another job immediately.
Owen Coyle.
Owen didn't last long.
And I think he hated living in Houston.
Yeah. Well, it's for an overweight, pasty white guy, Houston's not the place to be.
It really isn't.
It's not. So speaking of good coaches and the coaching tree in general, at the beginning of the year, we were questioning whether or not Anthony Pulis might be in over his head. It turns out maybe not. OCB has, over the last several games, even the game that they lost recently to Louisville City when they were up a man, has looked like a completely different team, Andrew. And I think that it is just a matter of finally getting that expansion group of players to play the system, to buy in, and to be a team. What are you seeing out of the USL side?
I think I was definitely one of those people that wasn't necessarily rating him. I think we've seen an evolution of this team. We've seen an ability to take out the parts that weren't working. We've seen him be able to create a side. But what we've also just really seen is a return to the fold for some people. Connor Donovan went and got his goal. We're seeing a lot more from the people that we were expecting for the MLS side. So I think having those pieces come in and be that development franchise, we've been able to piece together a side that's worked, and we haven't had to kind of blood them in MLS and suffer for it, we've been able to suffer in USL and then grow, and we've really seen that from this team. I think we're still making some stupid mistakes. Tyler Turner is certainly on my watch list for that. But we are starting to slowly roll, and for a first-time head coach with really a first-time coaching staff, you know, Rob Valentino, great player, mm-hmm. but first-time coach, with a lot of young people who are from a lot of different walks of life being asked to play with some people who are making exceedingly a lot more money than they are. We've eventually seen it mesh together, and I have to give him hats off to Pulis for making that work. And also, I think he's probably stood up to the club a little bit and said, you know what, Rochez isn't a good fit here either. I don't necessarily want him to be among my lads, and that makes a huge difference for this franchise moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Rochez is a disappointing case in that he just doesn't seem like he handled the loan the right way. The way you would want him to handle it is to go down and say, all right, I'm going to go down. I'm going to dominate for a few weeks. They're going to call me right back up, and then I'm going to be the super sub off the bench when, you know, when Kyle Aaron's in the game and he's getting tired in the 70th minute. They send me on to take his place, or if we're down a goal, they bring me on to you know, add to him and add to the attack. And you know, he's a guy that has enough talent that in three or four USL games, he could put up, you know, five or six goals. Mm-hmm. And he just did not handle it that way. And I know that, you know, part of it was missing in the entire training camp. He had an injury from his national team that was misdiagnosed or mishandled, and that took some time before they straightened it out. And then he had to go through basically all of a preseason while everybody was moving into the season. And that's, it's a very, very difficult thing. And we saw the same thing with Boxy Yamba, who was let go by the club. He had the same thing where he was behind and everybody had nailed down spots and he wasn't able to find time and he wanted to play. So he and the club agreed mutually to move him on. And so he'll go, you know, have the next adventure in his career. But for Brian Rochez, it's a very disappointing thing because you really want to see a guy respond in a positive way. And he has not done that. He's you know, maybe he's got that kind of a personality where he, you know, he loses confidence or something, but really it was a challenge to him and he didn't meet that challenge.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, there are a lot of people out there that would have killed for that challenge, would have loved that opportunity. And when you see somebody, I feel like I'm going to be pretty harsh, but throw it back at you, isn't great. And I think that makes it really hard to not just be motivated yourself, but it makes it really hard to mm-hmm. motivate those people that you have to step onto the field with. And right. that kind of showed in certain situations, because if you know, if you pass out that bad vibe of I don't want to be here, you know, some other people will start thinking that too, and oh, I can go get a better opportunity somewhere else. No, he had a pretty solid opportunity and a chance to take that next step, and instead he decided that he just didn't want to, and that hurts everybody, and but most of all himself.
Right. And the beneficiary is Haji Berry, who I believe he had three goals and an assist in a two-game span. He's really come on. I expect that he'll be playing a big part in the early rounds of the U.S. Open Cup for Orlando City. But yeah, Ant Pulis has the team playing well. They did not look like a competent soccer team at all in the early going. They've got a solid USL goalie in Mark Ridgers. We found that out pretty early on in that 0-0 draw where they were down to 10 men, and he kept them, you know, earned them a point. And you know, now they've got one of the best USL center back pairings with Devron Garcia and Connor Donovan, two guys that the club expects to be in MLS, you know, sooner rather than later. Mikey Ambrose has been, you know, phenomenal on the left side. Tyler Turner, when he keeps his emotions in check, has been very good on the right side. Of course, he didn't do that this week and put his team at great risk in Charleston. They had a 2-0 lead in stoppage time of the first half, and he pulled what DeAndre Yedlin did with the U.S. men's national team the other night and got two yellow cards very, very quickly. And just completely lost his mind. The second one was ridiculous because not only did he pick up a second yellow and get thrown out to leave his team to face, you know, to face superior numbers for a whole 45 minutes of the second half, but he did it in the box.
Yeah.
and gave them a goal, essentially, right before the half, threw them a lifeline in a game that they were really comfortable in. And it was silly. It wasn't even like a foul. He just, the guy went down to try to draw a call, didn't get it. You play on, the ref did the right thing, and Turner walks over, gets in his face, and ends up poking the guy in the eye. I don't know if he did actually touch him or if it was an act, but it doesn't really matter. If you confront a player, you're risking a yellow card. So you're already on a yellow, and you're literally seconds from getting to the locker room. So just a really foolish play by a young player.
Yeah, and I think this is what that franchise is about. It's about breeding that out and seeing if you can. If you can't, then unfortunately you're probably not going to move forward with this franchise. But it was a stupid mistake. I think we've seen them from him before. So it's a little worrying that they're not disappearing out of his game. We can't afford it. We've got enough players that pick up cards without adding another person to our MLS roster. Time will tell whether or not he can work out. I think there are a lot better prospects, like you say. Devron Garcia and Connor Donovan look like a pretty solid partnership if you ever run into international slot trouble like we may do next year. that we've got the ability to really bring those people through, and I think that's really important.
Yeah, and it just looks like Ant's got them playing very well. They know what they're doing, and they're starting to score goals. They're doing a good job of keeping the other team from scoring, and that was a big problem earlier in the year, and especially the scoring. I think at one point they had more red cards than they had goals, but early in the year. But they seem to have, for the most part, settled down. Turner did get a 2-game suspension, by the way, for not just the red card, but the yellow card accumulation. So. So yeah, he's going to be watching for a little bit, but OCB, good turnaround for them, and it's not too late. I believe they're eighth in the Eastern Conference, and there's no reason why they couldn't make up a couple more spots playing the way they have been playing, and potentially make a playoff run.
Yeah, I think they're more than capable. I was a little worried at the start, but they're really starting to put it all together. And going back to Turner, I think the risk with sitting 2 games is somebody can very easily come along and take your starting spot. He needs to be very careful because, 2 wrongs don't necessarily make a right, and you may not get that opportunity again.
That's the great thing about depth is that, if you make an error, you might be sitting a while trying to earn that spot back because the guys behind you are not a huge drop-off in talent anymore like they were. So... OCB moving forward it'll be a big test for them this weekend against New York Red Bulls too. So that'll be a good barometer to see really how far they've come. They definitely struggled a bit against Louisville, which is really the class of the entire USL now, it seems. And despite the fact that they had a lead against a 10-man side, they just kind of had a 3-minute span where they, kind of fell apart and maybe took their foot off the throat a little bit, and before they knew it, they were down 2 goals, even though they were up a man. So New York Red Bulls would be another opportunity for them, and to see if they learned anything from playing the league's better teams. So if you're around this weekend, if you're not going to Orlando City, you could maybe pop over there to the Titan Soccer Complex and check it out. Orlando Pride, Andrew. Having trouble on the road.
Yep.
Not scoring goals. I mean, it's one thing when you're not scoring goals because you don't have, Alex Morgan, and then Sarah Hagen leaves the game early. It's another thing entirely when you got a full, healthy team and you can't score goals. And, they've really struggled to score goals on the season on the road. They got one at Portland and a 2-1 loss. And they got one in a 1-0 win at Houston. And besides that, it's been goose eggs all over the place. Why can't this team score on the road?
I think because they're still an expansion side. We're asking them to play away from home. And, crowd support is important for expansion franchises. We saw that with the men's team. I think we're seeing that with the women's team. You have to be able to have that void and that atmosphere that kind of sometimes gets you through. If you concede an early goal away from home, it's completely uphill from there. If you concede an early goal at home, sorry, I think I got that wrong, away from home, it's uphill from there. If you concede it early at home, you've got that crowd that's behind you that keeps singing, that keep getting into it. And I think we're just not feeling it away from home. And I'm not hitting panic stations just yet. I think we're still an expansion franchise with people still learning it, the game, and we are being asked to switch in and out of teams fairly regularly right now. Not that other teams aren't as well, but we have to finally eventually put something together. And I think we'll come home eventually and be able to make it good on ourselves, but a month-long away stint also isn't really doing them any favors.
Yeah, the schedule's been a little bit tough. They've got still... at the Washington Spirit this Saturday. That's going to be very, very difficult. Washington Spirit, top of the league, and you know, a very, very good team. But if Orlando can get a result there, they come back not in too bad a shape from the road trip overall. If they come back with 6 points out of a possible 12 in a four straight games on the road situation, that's really, really good. And because they've got the next four sitting at home between June 23rd and July 16th, they may be missing their stars again for that Chicago game on the 16th, but they should have them for Houston, Portland, and Boston at home. And certainly they should beat Boston at home. Houston, they have done well against this year. Portland, you know, is going to be a difficult team no matter where you play them, but playing them at home will probably be a little bit better. That will take them into the Rio Olympic break, where they would play four out of five on the road, and then finish up with two at home against Sky Blue FC and FC Kansas City, both of those beatable teams, obviously. So right now it's about treading water and staying in contact, I think. And then, you know, if you get through those four games and win three of them in that stretch of four home games, if you win three of those, you're going to be right there in the thick of things. And then you just got to tread water again a little bit in that four out of five games, you know, leading up to the last two home games. If they can be in contention heading into the last two home games, I think they got a pretty good chance.
Yeah, I think they have the ability to keep it all together. We do have some pretty good depth, but I expect us to see some pickups in the offseason to kind of help with some of our problems that we've been seeing. But, you know, we're still an expansion franchise. I'm not going to lose my head about it too much. They will... continue to do what they can, I think, and time will tell. We have a good, strong roster, but this is what downtimes build great franchises, and we will come out of this probably better than if we just completely ran away with it. Nobody wants to do that, and that's not what NWSL or MLS is built upon.
Well, we have rambled quite a bit, and we still have a guest, a very special guest to get to. So why don't we do that right now, and we'll take a quick little mini break, and we'll be back with our guest right after this. Joining us on the Mainland Podcast this week, we're very fortunate to have with us Orlando City midfielder Servando Carrasco. Servando, how are you?
I'm doing well. Just hanging out here with my puppy, watching the U.S. Open, or trying to watch it because there's a rain delay. So we're just hanging out, relaxing.
Well, relaxing is the key word. I mean, you guys had a pretty long layoff in the middle of the season, which is unusual. I wanted to start off by asking, you know, a little bit about your time off for Copa America. I know you guys had about a week, and it looked like from the Instagram videos we saw that you had quite an interesting vacation.
Yeah, I guess it was nice to just get away for a few days. You know, it's just good to recharge and refocus and just come back ready for the second half of the season. You look at those last 3 weeks in May, and I think we had a lot of games. We had a lot of travel, too. So I think looking back, it was the perfect time to have that break. And just judging from how practice and training has been in the past 2 weeks, guys have come back, you know, recharged. And that was the main goal of that break. You know, guys that were injured, guys that were fatigued. And I think now we're all just ready to go.
Well, that sounds good because, the team, you know, they pick up some bumps and bruises, and it seems like Orlando City, for being sponsored by a healthcare corporation, seems to have more bumps and bruises than most, I think. But I want to talk a little bit about your position because I think probably defensive midfield is maybe the most underrated position in soccer. I mean, the you know, everybody loves the strikers and the goalkeepers and the glory boys center backs and the attacking players. But, you know, defensive midfield, maybe not the sexiest position, but, you know, I think it takes a little bit of a different mindset to play that position. I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about how you approach it and what your thoughts are on playing there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess growing up, most of my favorite players were defensive midfielders or center backs. You know, guys like Paul Scholes, Xabi Alonso, Mascherano, Rafa Márquez, Puyol, like the list goes on and on. And I think it's just guys that I identified with. You know, D-mid is by far my favorite position. I think there's a lot of responsibility that comes along with it. And I kind of embrace that. I think it's, you know, you're involved on both sides of the ball. I mean, you don't really have the luxury to take shortcuts or can, you know, switch off mentally, because I think when that happens, it's usually the defensive midfielder's fault when something breaks down. So it's a position that I really enjoy. I obviously love to get on the ball, and in this system that we play, the 4-2-3-1, I think the defensive midfielders are very important. So, yeah, I think that with every game, I've gotten more comfortable with the responsibility and with that position. And, yeah, I'm just really looking forward to growing more.
Now, in Adrian Heath's system, obviously he likes his fullbacks to get forward. What does that do to you as a defensive midfielder, like your responsibilities in terms of if Breck goes forward, if Rafael Ramos goes forward, where do you slide? What do you see on the field, and what are your keys?
Yeah, well, obviously, if I'm playing on the right side of the defensive midfielder spot, if Rafa pushes forward, which he does do a lot, and he does it really well, I always have to be aware of that space that he vacates. So if something breaks down, usually teams now play with a 10 that kind of plays in those soft spots. So, I mean, a guy that you can think about is Piatti. So Piatti is the type of guy who can cheat defensively. So if Rafa pushes into his space, and then Piatti drops into like the space that he's vacated, the only thing that he's waiting for is for that counterattack. So I just have to be aware of that with guys like that, with players like that. So when things do break down, you kind of just have to cover that space that was left by the right or the left back.
Well, you talked a little bit about, you know, your approach to the position and what it's like to play defensive midfield. Who are some of the guys in MLS that have really tested you and given you a hard time as far as opponents are concerned?
As far as opponents, I'd say the hardest guys to play against would be Javier Morales from Real Salt Lake, Diego Valeri from Portland, Piatti for sure. Let me think who else. But it's not only those guys. It's guys that I also watch, guys that I want to play like. You look at a guy like Alonso from Seattle. That's a guy that I got to play with for 3 years, and that's a guy that I learned a lot from, and I think he's still the best defensive midfielder in this league. So just playing against those guys and playing with them, I think that I've learned a lot. And, yeah, I think there's a lot of emphasis on that number 10 right now, and there is kind of that free-flowing style, so they don't really have that central midfielder spot. They can play wherever. So, yeah, it's definitely hard to defend, but it's a challenge that I definitely look forward to.
Speaking of defensive midfielders, you know, the team has had, you know, has brought in Antonio Nocerino this year, and Antonio is he's not like a traditional maybe a defensive midfielder, but he's kind of struggled to find his footing with the team this year. And I know that the fans, you know, fans being what we are, we're very, you know, we want instant results and we're impatient. But tell us a little bit about what you see in practice from this guy and, you know, what actually he's very good at that maybe we don't see and hasn't translated yet to the field.
Yeah, look, I have huge respect for Antonio. He's a guy that comes in and works hard and never complains. And, you know, he's trying to get back into match fitness. And We've seen it before with players. We've seen it with Gerrard. We've seen it with Beckham. We've seen it with Pirlo. We've seen it with Lampard. Guys that, you know, make the jump to the MLS. And, you know, this is a league that's very physically demanding. It's a lot of running. It's a lot of travel, too. So, you know, it kind of takes time for those players to adapt. And I think if you give them more time, then you're going to see that quality shine through. I mean, this is a guy who's a very good passer. He's got a very good touch. But I think the main thing for him is match fitness and, you know, just still competing and just being ready for that next opportunity for him.
Now, it's a little bit odd because we've recorded this week's podcast in two settings. We recorded the first part on Tuesday, and then this part with you I'm recording on Thursday. You guys played last night, and you got to play with Antonio in the U.S. Open Cup match against Jacksonville, which was a big 1-0 win, and the team moves on to the fifth round. What was it like to get back on the field after being off for a few weeks and playing a different team rather than just against your teammates?
Yeah, I guess physically the first half was a little demanding for sure. I mean, the last time that we played a full 90 was three weeks ago. So it was a hot day and it was hard. But, you know, in the second half, you kind of get that second win. So we definitely played a lot better in the second half. You know, it's just one of those games where it's going to be very competitive because for them, it's the biggest game of the season. And for us, I guess it was too, but you know, it was definitely a difficult game. I thought that our response from not playing for 3 weeks was really good. And look, we had some really good moments. I think you look back at the game and we created a huge goal scoring opportunity in the first 30 seconds. So if we put that away, you know, I think the game changes. But overall, I think we created some good chances. We had some good play, and I think it's definitely something that we can build off of.
Now you've gotten a lot of time this year, and arguably it could be said you're playing your best best soccer of your MLS career so far. One of the things that I thought about, you know, leading up to this interview was I thought that, you know, probably for the first time you and your wife are in the same city, and I just wondered how much that plays into your mental state, and how much does that help you or relax, or does it help you at all?
I mean, it definitely does help me. If I didn't say that, she'd probably kill me. it's just nice to, like, come back home and have dinner with your wife and just go to the movies and things that we haven't been able to do in the past 6 years. And it's just nice to live a normal life. And, yeah, I think we're so fortunate to be here together, and we're also so grateful. It's nice to go to her games and just see our practice and little things like that. So, yeah, I think I feel more comfortable for sure having her here, and, you know, just kind of having those little moments where we can actually hang out and be husband and wife, because it's kind of hard to do that when I'm living in Houston and she's living in Portland, or I'm living in Seattle and she's living in Buffalo. So finally it feels like we're home. So that's definitely nice to say for sure.
That's great. You know, speaking of which, you served as captain last night in the U.S. Open Cup game, and I believe that makes you to the first husband and wife team to captain teams at the top flight in this country, maybe anywhere. That's kind of a neat thing.
Yeah, I guess I didn't even think about it until you mentioned it, but yeah, I guess that is pretty neat.
So you got a stretch of games coming up where, you know, every point is vital, obviously. The team has had a lot of draws this year, especially at home. How do you guys approach – I mean, these might have been losses last year because the team was still coming together. How do you approach this next series of games and say, you know, get over that hump and get the 3 points instead of the 1 point, or maybe if you're behind late, maybe you turn a loss into a draw? How do you take that next step as a team?
Well, I think first and foremost, what those draws show you is that we're a very difficult team to beat. You know, there's been games where we're down a goal in the 90th minute and somehow, some way, we found a way to come back. So I think that speaks to the group. I think there's a lot of chemistry in this group. There's a lot of some camaraderie. And look, I don't think that just happens by chance. We all believe in what we're trying to build here. And we have a great opportunity with two home games that are coming up. You know, we have a great opportunity when we play Fort Lauderdale too. So it's like, we're all focused on these two games that are coming up at home. If we can pick up, you know, six points at home, that puts us back in the top two teams. So, you know, this year it's so close. I mean, you look around the league and I think we're tied in fifth place with four teams or something like that. So I think every goal is going to be important. I think every point's going to be important. So yeah, we have a great challenge coming up, but we also have two games at home that we have to take advantage of.
All right, well, speaking of those two games coming up, you've got San Jose Earthquakes have been a team that's been very, very difficult to break down. Don't know yet. Depending on what happens tonight with the U.S. men, we won't know till after this goes live whether or not Wondolowski's in the lineup or not. But obviously, Quincy Amarquois is a good player, and Matias Perez-Garcia is a good player for San Jose. And then, of course, Giovinco and Michael Bradley possibly for that Toronto game. Can you tell us a little bit about what it's like to face those guys and what problems they present for the defense?
Yeah, I actually played against Quincy in college. He went to UC Davis, and I was at Cal. Mm-hmm. And he's a handful. I mean, he's one of those guys who works from minute one to minute 90, similar to Dom, to Dom Dwyer. And that for a defensive line is just a nightmare because you can't check off. I mean, he's a guy who's going to look for those loose balls. He's a guy that's going to tackle you. So, yeah, he's very dangerous, and I think the combination with him and Wando is a very good one. So if they do end up playing together, we definitely have to be ready for that. And going off of what you were saying, that they're a very difficult team to break down, I played for Dom in Houston. Yeah, his teams are very organized. They have a really good back line. So it's going to be maybe one of those games where we have to be patient, where we have to control the tempo and, you know, maybe pass and get it wide and bring it back. So that's kind of what we're working on, you know, just being more patient and, you know, finding that final pass in the final third.
Yeah, and maybe that was a good practice you had against Jacksonville because it looked like they wanted to stay behind the ball and stay organized and maybe wait for a break on the counter. So maybe you got a little bit of taste of what you're going to see Saturday.
No, for sure. I think it was totally that. In the first half, you know, it was kind of hard to break them down. We were trying to go wide. We were trying to go wide. And, you know, we got a couple crosses here and there, but it wasn't until the second half that we finally found that rhythm. And we were able to play centrally and then wide. So I think if we can do that against San Jose on Saturday, we should be very, very successful.
All right, Servando, before I let you go, I got to talk about this a little bit. Your vacation videos with you guys creating these crazy golf videos and the one where you kick the ball up and Brett chests it down and Bendick hits it with the golf club. How did you guys think of that stuff?
It was funny. I mean, we all just woke up. We were having breakfast. It was about, I don't know, 8:39. And we were just, I don't know, just hanging around watching TV or whatever. And then we had the golf clubs out, so we started playing golf. We just, like, chipped a couple balls into the pool. And then slowly we got the soccer ball involved, and slowly we got, you know, the tennis racket involved. So it was just, like, yeah, it's something that just turned into from, like, trick shots to then playing 60-yard diagonal balls to the beach. And, yeah, it was actually pretty fun.
Well, it looked a lot of fun. And we did a poll. We did a little story on the site about the you know, how you spent your Copa vacation, and I think most of the people said they'd rather spend it with you guys hanging out, creating sports. So, Servando Carrasco, midfielder for Orlando City, thank you so much for being with us on the Mainland Podcast, and, you know, we wish you nothing but the best of luck throughout the rest of the season.
Thank you so much, guys, and I'll see you on Saturday.
Well, that'll just about do it for another edition, episode number 53, in fact, of the Mainland Podcast. I want to thank our guest, Servando Carrasco, defensive midfielder for Orlando City, for being with us on the show this week. And, of course, thank you to Orlando City for making a player available to us. We appreciate that. We always enjoy talking to the guys and getting their perspective on things. Andrew, before we get out of here, big game coming back to MLS play this weekend. Home against San Jose Earthquakes. What's your key matchup, and what's your final score prediction?
So it's going to be interesting. Obviously, there's going to be a lot of emotion at Saturday night's game. I think it's going to be one for a little bit of everybody. I think it will be a hard-fought contest. I got to say, wingbacks against for Tayalashi, I still really rate him. I think he's having a great season, and they just have such a strong powerful midfield, and I think if our wing backs don't have the ability to recover, and I think Ramos will be back for this game, so I'm expecting Shea Ramos to line up in those positions. I think they're really going to have a hard time, and if they overpower us there in that position, I expect them to be able to really have a lot of shots on goal and really make it difficult for us. And we may see, you know, I'm pretty sure, you know, Sherrod probably will get the start due to Wondolowski's unavailability. So it will be interesting. I'm going to go wing backs against the defense, and I can't see Orlando not winning this game with what Saturday will mean to the city. So I'm going 3-1, and I expect it to be a very powerful game from us.
Yeah, with the events that transpired over the weekend, we have purposely steered clear of the topic, just, you know, out of respect for everybody involved. It's been talked about by people who are much more appropriate and much more
capable
exactly of talking about it than we are. So we've purposely let that go. But it will be a very emotional night on Saturday night at Camping World Stadium when San Jose comes to town. My key matchup. See, there's two ways it can go too. When it's that emotional, is you can, the emotions can overcome you, or you can channel them, and hopefully Orlando City will channel those the right way and ride those to a big win. I think for me the key matchup is that the Earthquakes don't give up a lot of goals, so it's going to be the Orlando City attack force, meaning those attacking midfielders and Kyle Larin up top, to break them down and be able to score goals, because they don't give up a lot of goals, and it's going to be important to you know, especially hopefully get an early goal and kind of, you know, shake them up a bit, maybe get them doubting themselves, test their mettle, so to speak. So that's my key matchup. I think that Kyle Larin has to score a goal, and then maybe another one from Kaká or Kevin Molino, who's been fantastic this year. Kevin Molino, as our Jeff Milby wrote this week, potentially the favorite for comeback player of the year. As far as a final prediction, I'm going to say 2-1 to Orlando City. I think it's a good effort by the lads, and I think maybe they get a late one and hopefully, you know, make San Jose wilt down the stretch and use that heat and humidity of Orlando to their advantage and get the late winner and send everybody home happy and you know, give the city a cathartic win.
Yeah.
So there you have it. Did you give me a final score?
Yeah, 3-1. I didn't give 3-1, you scorers. Okay. Okay. I think Larin kind of keeps going. Molino. And I think we get something off a set piece this week, and I'm probably going to go with a Seb Hines header. I think we can kind of get back to it, but, you know, Kaká has to stop kicking the ball out of bounds on corners. you're getting paid way too much, my friend, to keep doing that.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see too how well rested the Brazilian is coming back from his injury. You know, with the Brazilian national side, a muscle strain and how much work he was able to do. I know that when he comes back fresh, he's usually very good at putting the ball where he wants to. So that will be a key. If he's able to play and to contribute in that manner, then you know, that the team is much better when it can get something off a set piece. Mm-hmm. So. That will do it for episode 53 of the Mainland Podcast. And boy, did we talk your ear off this week. But I think it was good. I think it was a good show, good conversation. And with you, Andrew, it's always a pleasure to talk soccer and to talk Orlando City soccer. And in this particular instance, to talk international soccer. And, of course, thanks again to our guest, Servando Carrasco. Always great to have, you know, professional soccer player on your podcast.
Mm-hmm. Always good.
All right, so Andrew, on your behalf, thank you very much for being with me this week. And this is Michael Citro signing off episode 53 saying, Go City!